would stare at the clouds and wonder what I would become. My imagination ran wild. One day, a man came promising a better life far away.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm David Batstone, and this short video is about the Not For Sale campaign that I helped start 3 years ago with two partners. And today we're going to talk about how business, as a way of doing mission, also addresses a social problem in a way that perhaps is unique. Because of the fact that really at Not For Sale campaign, we seriously want to end slavery in our lifetime. It's not a platform or an agenda where we feel we can start a cool nonprofit. We seriously want to see slavery end. Be it young kids who are forced to sew clothes in a rug factory or in a clothing factory in Cambodia, young children who are child soldiers in northern Uganda, young girls from Thailand or Korea who are serving customers in a brothel in Los Angeles or Boston. We want to see that end. And to do that, we stepped back and did an analysis of what would it take in 25 years to make global slavery something that was out of the ordinary. Because today, it is all too ordinary. What would it take in 25 years? What would need to happen? And we discovered, as we did our analysis, that there would need to be a cultural shift about the acceptance that young boys and girls could be sold into slavery and deployed as forced labor. It would require political change, better laws in the enforcement of those laws, and addressing the corruption around those laws when they once are put into effect. And finally, it would require an economic or business solution. In this video, a young girl from Eastern Europe is economically vulnerable and therefore is deceived into going overseas to leave her country, to leave her home, and when she leaves her home, her documents are taken from her, and she is forced to serve men's pleasures in a brothel. That is a common scenario for young people around the globe today. The average age of a young girl or a boy who comes into the sex slave industry is 14 globally today. That is inside the United States and outside the United States. Economically vulnerable people. So in order to address that, the Not For Sale campaign has been deploying business and economic alternatives in a various strategies that I want to go through today. But before I go there, I want to take a step back because I want to suggest to you that perhaps some of you have a calling as a business professional to bring about the good news to the poor. When I was a student at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, I remember sitting in chapel and I'd hear speakers come and talk about a calling to mission. And it was almost a sense of relief that I wasn't one of those kind of ministry nerds or social justice nerds, but I was being called to something else, business or law or nursing, or medicine of any type, or physical exercise science, or whatever your major might be, that somehow we perceive that only those people who are called to ministry are called to serve God. Well, that's a lie, and it's not scriptural. We are all called to God's service. It's just how we perhaps are wired differently, how we have been created in the image of God in different ways to serve a world that's God's world, a world in need. So business as mission comes back to my calling as an individual, my personal calling, to your vocation, because I am convinced, as a follower of Jesus, that I am not called to a career, I'm called to a vocation. And my vocation is where my passion, what I just feel like, you know, there's things that you just feel wired to do. where my passion meets the needs of the world. That's a vocation. And each of you here today are called to a vocation. And through prayer and through scriptural reading and through community, we find our gift and how it meets the needs of the world. So that's vocation. We may be called then as business entrepreneurs, people who understand how to use capital in such a way that it can generate wealth. We may be called to do that as a specific vocation to bring healing to God's world. That's what business as mission is. Business as missions, unfortunately, has been narrowed to a very refined and narrow band called tent maker ministry, which usually means losing money but trying to break even while you do evangelism. Now, it very well might be that you will be called to a location in the world where to be an evangelist, you'll need to do something as a tent maker. That's fine. And that is one specific area of business's mission. But that is not all business's mission. That is a strategic response to a political or cultural limitation. But it is not what defines what it means to do business's mission. What I'm opposed today is that doing business as mission requires doing business with excellence, requires doing business like we would do it in a normal, profitable business. Though it may be, as Christians, we begin to think more broadly about how we carry out the bottom line. I mean, the company will not be around in 10 years if it's not financially profitable. It will not inspire workers who are highly qualified to come and work for it. It will not make its mark with customers and stakeholders unless it is financially profitable. But what if those who are called to a vocation of business also held a social return in mind, that they measure their success based on the impact on those stakeholders who are engaged, be it the community, be it the workers who are in that company, or perhaps even those who are investors? What does it mean to think of business in a broader sense? And that's what I want to look at today, using business in that broader sense to be able to engage individuals in a new kind of living, discipleship, following Jesus through our entrepreneurial skills. Now, several years ago, I wrote a book called Saving the Corporate Soul, because I'm convinced that there are people who are called to the corporate business environment. But their calling is no less a mission to promote the good news of Jesus Christ than for someone who goes to Peru to set up a social venture enterprise. It just has to be looked at in a different way. What does it mean to be engaged in business as mission at Apple? Business as mission at Microsoft? What does it mean to do business as mission at The Gap? It doesn't mean just showing up to work on time and not lying about your product. It's not just about honesty and integrity. What does it mean to do business differently? I set out to do an investigation of how a company could practice its operational machine in such a way that it reflected a certain soul or sense of values. And I featured 50 companies, big companies, medium-sized companies, and small companies. So Saving the Corporate Soul was a way of addressing how companies could be profitable without losing their soul. But it always required individuals in leadership who brought to their work a different set of values that informed the way they approached their work. I want to give you an example of a company, Hanna Andersson. Hanna Andersson Clothes. It's a great kid clothing. The founder of Hanna Andersson Clothes, she named the company after her grandmother, Hanna Andersson. Her name is Jen Dinhart. She's Swedish. And she discovered that she didn't have for her children, she had multiple children, she didn't have any good cotton clothing. So what she began to do is she, with her husband in their kitchen, started cutting out this fabric and put it in a little square, pasted it to a postcard, and started to create a mailing list where they send out this cloth and said, hey, wouldn't you like to see your kids in that clothes? That kind of cloth. And they started to get some sales, and so their inventory was, let me see, all the pants went in the living room, and all of the shirts went in the garage, and all the, you know, one-piece suits went into the kitchen. So they used their house as their beginning point for Hanna Andersen clothes. They then sat down about 9 months into it and said, how do we start a different kind of marketing campaign that suggests to people that this is really a different kind of clothing for your kids? And so what they decided to do was to create a program called Hanna Downs, which were a type of clothing that you would, if you send in, let me say you bought some Hanna Andersen clothes, you could send the clothes back after your child has worn it for 2 or 3 years, and it would be a return, a hand-me-down, and we would give you a 20% discount on the next item of clothing that you bought. It was called Hanna Downs. And it was a way of saying, you know what, your kids will outlive the clothes. That is, they are so durable, the cloth is so good, that it will remain in such good use, you can return it as a hand-me-down, and we'll let you buy another piece of clothing. Well, it was a great marketing campaign. Hanna Andersen exploded. But what they didn't figure on was that they had, what were we going to do with all these hand-me-downs now? They hadn't thought about what they were going to do with the clothing that their customers sent in as a hand-me-down. So they started going to shelters in the area, in the Portland area where they were located, and said, look, we have all these clothes we'd like to give to you as a part of our operation. And their customers then slowly began to buy more clothes because they felt so good about the fact that Hanna Andersen was now engaged with the community and helping shelters. First in Portland, then Seattle, then all over the United States as Hanna Andersen grew. And before long, when people bought a pair of Hanna Andersen clothes, they did it because not only was it good for their kids, not only did they get a discount when they returned it, and they also had a sustainable, they weren't then kind of recycling clothing, they're feeling good about their environmental impact, but they're also helping kids who couldn't afford to buy first-time use Hanna Andersen clothes. Became a wildly successful company, and it's ironic that the CEO who started the company as a way of giving good clothing for kids like her own, she ended up starting a foundation for children in the United States in communities that were vulnerable. And she said, I thought I was starting a company, and I realized it evolved into a cause. Now, Ms. Dunard doesn't do that because simply she wanted to start a social cause company. On the other hand, she had a sensibility or value about doing something different with her entrepreneurial skills. So that I'm suggesting someone who says, that must be a follower of Jesus. They do business differently. Is it reflected in the way that we do our profession that we have a vocation? Or do we do it the same as everyone else does it? That there's a script that's written, and it doesn't matter what our faith is, no matter what our values is, because that's something that I hold Jesus in my heart, and I keep Jesus imprisoned in my heart, because he's not going to get involved in my work week. He's not going to get involved in my vocation. It won't be reflected in how I do my work because of the fact that God has nothing to do with the rest of my life, only what happens in my heart and in my prayers. That is not the faith that you read in the New Testament or throughout the Scripture. Let Jesus out of the prison of your heart into the world. Let Jesus out of the prison of your heart and let Jesus direct you to a new kind of living out in the world. I was asked to speak at Wheaton College not long ago. It was a conference on God and business, God and profit. And I think they probably invited me to be the agitator. I didn't realize that at the time. Because there were folks who really disagreed with the fact that there was any other kind of business than the one that made financial profit. That there was no other metric by which you might gear your business. Well, I'm an entrepreneur. I started many companies, and I'll talk about that later. And I realize that when I create a business, there's many elements that go into a successful business. The workforce and how I pay them, the resources and where I get those resources for the construction of a product. There's also the facilities I use. It's also the amount of distribution. There's a lot of factors that go into it. At the end of the year, I'm hopeful that I get a profit, right? I wouldn't do it otherwise, because then I am not ensuring that my enterprise will be something that will shape life 10 years from now. In fact, it's going to be a struggle. So I try to find enterprises where I think will be successful financially and that's a profit. But in the equation of building that business, there's many factors about that profitability. Now, I'll give you the extreme example is, how did I get into fighting modern slavery, human trafficking? I ran into it in my local restaurant in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a place I had gone every couple of weeks for several years, and I never had the screen to note that the young children from India who were working in this restaurant, 13, 14, 15, up to 16 years old, would be anything other than extended members of the family who owned the restaurant. I pick up my newspaper in San Francisco one morning, and there I see my favorite restaurant was the center of a human trafficking ring that had brought over 500 young adolescents from the country of India into the United States for the purpose of involuntary servitude. It's what the U.S. Constitution refers to as slavery. Involuntary servitude. Not a sweatshop with low wages, not people smuggling. It is abducting or forcing people to work against their will and taking those profits so that someone else can benefit. Slavery. In the United States, in San Francisco, in the 21st century. And in fact, it's in your city, no matter where you live in the United States today or around the globe, human trafficking reaches to your backyard. I couldn't believe it. Well, that Indian restaurant could competitively get a higher profit because they weren't paying their workers, right? I mean, compare having to pay workers to not paying workers. Who's going to make more of a profit? So when I was at Wheaton College talking at this conference about excess profit, how do we define what is just to those who are stakeholders? The CEOs who were on the panel with me were laughing, and they said, "Hey, John, I don't think I've ever seen excess profit. Have you?" "I've never had excess profit." Thinking it's funny that you could make too much money. You see where it's going? But at some place, you define what is a just profit, which is legitimate in order to reward those who take risks, reward those with incentives so that they work for an enterprise that grows, but also is just to the elements that take part in that business. What does it mean to do just business? What would that look like? To me, it requires a generation of entrepreneurs, and it's going to have to be a younger generation, who look at the impact on the environment, they look at the impact on the people who produce those products that we sell in the retail stores, be it Sears or Walmart, or be it the small corner store. What does it mean to do work differently? We work differently. All right. You know, it almost seems to me sometimes that the Christian church thinks that Adam Smith is more of a guide for economic behavior than Jesus Christ. That is, that if as long as you create profit, the market will distribute that in some just way. We don't have to worry about that. Historically, that has not proven true. I am a capitalist, but I am also informed by Jesus Christ. I choose capitalism because I find it to be the most effective method for generating wealth for the most amount of people. But it is not my religion. There's a difference. It is not my religion. We follow Jesus Christ. We look for the best tools to implement our faith at a given point in time in history. And I believe at that point in time, it requires us to be creative in how we do entrepreneurial activity with a keen sense of justice and mercy and compassion. Now, how does that play itself out in business's mission today? Well, I want to apply it in a very specific way to how we look at fighting modern slavery. Because we looked at it in terms of the actual projects that we ourselves could generate as a campaign, not for sale campaign, as well as shaping those companies which have a lot more economic power in the world today, existing companies. How do we do both and look at a 25-year plan to ending slavery? Let me start with how we shape the protocol of other companies, and then I'll turn to how we ourselves generate wealth for those who are vulnerable. We have a program, it's called Free to Work. We are able to go to companies and invite them that they will make sure that wherever they operate in the world, they will not, like my Indian restaurant in San Francisco, be using forced labor. When I went around the world in an investigation, went to every continent, I was shocked to find that I was linked to slavery in ways that I wasn't even aware of. The shirts I wear, do you know where your shirt was made? I didn't. The shoes I had on, the coffee I drank, the sugar I poured in my coffee, on and on, I was linked to slavery in the ways that I consume. Well, I don't think, look, I do not want to wear people's tragedy. I do not want to trample on other people's dreams. I do not want to consume other people's suffering. But how would I know that? How would I know that Firestone, Bridgestone tires are being produced in Liberia with 20 lawsuits against them today for slavery in their plantation in Liberia? How would you and I know that? If you knew that, you might then see Bridgestone, Firestone tires and say, I think I'm going to buy some Pirellis, because they monitor their supply chain to make sure that no slaves are being used. But how would you know that, and how would I know that? We didn't. So we created a tool called Free to Work. If you go to Free to Work, you're able then to look at products and look at their supply chain. We have 40 different metrics we apply to those products, and they will get an ABCDF. You're very familiar with that grading system. Based on how they go about addressing the fact that supply chain around the world is oftentimes used to exploit the vulnerable. You will find great companies. You will find great companies. It's funny, you know, Levi Jeans, back in the 70s, they had some real problems with their supply chains. They did no monitoring. They found that there's a lot of supply chain problems, slavery. Today, Levi's has one of the best apparel industry supply chain monitoring going on. They get a strong B in our grading system. If you got those Zuzu hamsters for your nieces and nephews or your little brothers and sisters, I'm sorry, but you got them a slave toy. Other children were not free to play by using that. You now have a place to go, Free to Work. We just started so that the critical mass of products will be sufficient for you to be able to go to a store and be able to know whether or not you are supporting slavery with your consumer habits or not. Well, still, you got to go online before, right? You have to go on the internet before you go shopping. That's kind of a hassle. I don't know what I'm going to see on the shelf. Well, that's why we are now in negotiation with Apple, who are going to create a little app for us. Where you're in the store, it's like the red laser. You put your iPhone or your BlackBerry, you could put the barcode, you see it get an ABCDF. Now you have no excuse, right? Now you have no excuse. You know. And do you want to really wear people's suffering? Do you want to trample on people's dreams? Do you want to consume their suffering? No. You don't want to do that, do you? You're people who follow Jesus. Of all people, you should shop differently. So, here's a tool. Meanwhile, we get to visit companies like Malachi Family Nuts. I went there to visit them in San Diego recently. It's a company that supplies all the cashews and almonds for Starbucks and Trader Joe's. The CEO, founder, is a believer. And so I went to Mike Malachi and said, Mike, I know you're a believer in Jesus. I am too. Would you pledge that your company would not use forced labor wherever you grow or produce your products? He said, of course. Now, part of that pledge is saying, one, yes, of course we will not do that. Two, we will be transparent. And three, you can go and visit our plantations anytime. Where do you grow your cashews and your almonds, Mike? Indonesia, Mexico, Southern California. Can we send our investigators who go to our academy, many of them college students or out of college, they get trained to be investigators, and go and take pictures, talk to the local community groups, to the workers themselves? Sure, of course we can. Now that's the kind of cashew and almond I want to buy. Imagine then, with critical mass building, we get to a place where there are a lot of free-to-work companies, but then there's some that are not. And the question is, why aren't you a free-to-work company? Now, you might think, I'm a terrible dreamer. See, I want to end slavery. I don't want to be sitting up here at Urbana in 20 years saying, I want to tell you about all the clever things we're doing. I want to end slavery. And to build the kind of leverage that would enable a change in values and protocol and behavior by economic powers, you have to bring about a change in the leverage, right? You got to create a change in the sea change. It's starting to happen. 2 months ago, I got a call from the largest lettuce, tomato, and tobacco growers in the United States. They said, we heard about your tool, we've seen it, we see the storm clouds coming. There's a generation of people who are going to start buying with their values. They will not pay for forced labor. They will not pay for slavery. Would you come and help us figure out how we can get on top of that? I couldn't believe it. So I went out to Tobacco Land out in North Carolina, and I met with all of the retailers and the growers. It was amazing. They seriously, not because some of them had a fit of conscience, they saw that people were starting to act, right? That's where your individual action together creates a sea change. All right, so that's shaping behavior. That's business, in a sense, shaping values, changing the way that companies go about producing. Well, that's one way that we began to address how we could change slavery by deploying business. The more companies that change, the more impact we have. Well, there's a product that all of us are probably implicated in. This is a time for confession. Tell me, who here has, in the last year, if you could raise your hand with a little bit of honesty, how many of you have bought a chocolate bar in the last year? Now look around. Pretty darn ubiquitous. Well, if I were to tell you that 70% of the world's supply of cocoa beans for chocolate that we buy in our stores comes from areas that are rife with child slavery. Forbes magazine told me this, not something I'm making up. 70% of the world's supply of cocoa beans. Well, then you say, well, there's something we really have to change. Now, William Wilberforce tried to fight slavery from the transatlantic supply chain, all right, a couple hundred years ago. He chose one product as an economic product that would be used to symbolize why slavery had to change, but also had an economic impact. You know what that one product was? Sugar. All right, he chose sugar. And once he was able to boycott sugar or address the fact that sugar is tied to the slave trade of his time, then it had a cultural and political impact in the UK. Well, we have chosen a product that is very ubiquitous to our lives, chocolate. Right? Now, it's really interesting. Cadbury's is one of the biggest chocolate manufacturers in the world. Right? Well, Cadbury's has made a pledge that starting next year, they will no longer use slave-made chocolate. They will, down to the cocoa bean, monitor that kids are, and families are being free to work on their chocolate plantations for every chocolate bar sold in the United Kingdom market. Why the United Kingdom market? Because there were enough people in the UK that said, we will not buy slave-made chocolate. Well, our friends at World Vision in Australia, they're very active organization in Australia. More so, their brand recognition in Australia is 97%. Much larger than any NGO in America, maybe like the Red Cross. Well, they heard about this and said, well, what? We don't want to buy slave-made chocolate here. So they had a campaign on television and through the newspapers and through local churches all through Australia. So Cadbury said, okay, we won't send our slave-made chocolate to Australia. Guess where all the slave-made chocolate is coming in 2010? To the fat, happy Americans. That's where it's coming. Right? It's going to come here because they know we don't care. It's as simple as that. They know we don't care. Mars saw what Cadbury is doing and said, okay, throughout the world in 2020, we promise we will no longer use slave-made chocolate. All right. Listen, I'm a realist. 2020 is better than 2025. The goal of the Not For Sale campaign is to get 2020 down to 2016. And then 2014, right? Get it down. How do we go about doing that? By the way, that means if I bought a Snickers, M&M's, Kit Kat, Hershey's in the last year, I'm contributing to the slave trade. don't want to do that anymore. So we started this campaign.
Chocolate's an indulgence. There's plenty of profit in it. We eat so much of it. Why is child labour and trafficked children part of me paying a lower price for my block of chocolate? That's wrong. I think most Australians would be shocked. For me, I don't want blood on my teeth when I eat chocolate. I don't want to be part of that. Most Australians don't. That's why we need to say to the industry, what are you doing? You can clean this up. This is where it all starts, the supply chain. Tim Costello, deep inside the jungles of West Africa's Ivory Coast, in search of proof Australian chocolate is a product of forced child labour and slavery. Disturbingly, the evidence is easy to find.
Well, work yourself now. You've been doing it for 3 years already, haven't you?
Ivory Coast and Ghana produce more than half the world's supply of cocoa, the raw ingredient of chocolate grown on thousands of small plantations. And millions of dollars worth is imported into Australia by big manufacturers, including Cadbury, Nestle and Mars, each year to satisfy our appetite. And this is the human cost. Young children born without the most basic freedom. The freedom of choice.
In the village I went to, both in Ghana and in Cote d'Ivoire, I asked 300 kids assembled there, who goes to school? Not one hand went up. Who wants to go to school? Every hand went up. Who wants to be a cocoa farmer? Not one hand went up. Because this is terrible work. Long, hazardous work that locks you out of what a childhood is and what an education is. That's terrible.
Are some of them tortured?
Some of these children certainly beaten. If they want to express a different view and run away, they're caught and they're kept there. In some families, children are just expected to work. In lots of these families, trafficked children are brought in because they're the cheapest labour.
But we're concerned when we hear stories that children might be working in dangerous conditions to produce the cocoa.
Tim's come here to West Africa to offer comfort and a promise of help.
That your farms, your children are safe, that you are being paid a fair price.
And he's determined to awaken the conscience of Australian chocolate eaters.
Every Australian would feel the revulsion of that. It's almost like a psychic vomit to think that that's going on. The industry knows this.
In fact, chocolate manufacturers have known since 2001 the cocoa they import is passed through the hands of child labour and slaves. Back then, Nine Sunday program helped expose and document stories of torture and abuse. Seven years on, children are still being trafficked, working up to 18-hour days, unpaid, unable to leave, controlled by their farms.
So we did it, the Not For Sale campaign, modeled a initiative in the United States that would, in a sense, take advantage of the momentum that Australia and World Vision is able to do. So particularly in churches and universities all over the United States, we now have fair trade chocolate campaigns where you can get a fair trade chocolate bar to sell on your campus or on your in your church. And of that, $3 is able to go to build a school where these kids formerly were enslaved. Also, by selling this on campus, you say, you know what? Don't buy Snickers and Hershey's and Cadbury's until they change their behavior. Buy this kind of chocolate. That you also are able then to educate them about being powerful consumers with values. So what have I talked about so far? I've talked about, one, how we as people who work in a company that might be considered a mainstream company, how do we change their values so that they match a more humane world, one that matches our values to say all people are loved in God's sight. All people are valued as God's image. How do we as consumers change our behavior? But how do we then, as investors, those of us who have resources or are entrepreneurs, how do we also then contribute to a world where Our calling or vocation as entrepreneurs can be used for the healing and good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. How do we exercise that? We like to call that at Not For Sale, we call it smart philanthropy. Smart philanthropy that uses capital, that uses investment appropriate to the type of enterprise that is being created. We have two types of activities around finances. We have a fund that is a for-profit fund. It's called the Right Reality Fund. That is right, hopefully not wrong, reality, not illusion, fund. The Right Reality Fund. And we have a newsletter that goes out to about 25,000 entrepreneurs every week. It's called the WAG, Worthwhile and Gain. But part of this is, if we are to invest in a company where we see that there's a social return, that is, it has a social impact, it creates jobs or schools for vulnerable people like those who would be enslaved otherwise, or people who are coming out of trafficking situations. And I'll take you through three case studies of how we've implemented this. So there's the for-profit fund that returns an annual yield to an investor, so that if you had an investment of $10,000, you could put it into the Right Reality Fund. At the end of the year, we would be giving you a guaranteed 5.25% back. Now that's pretty good given what banks are giving today. And we would be using that money to create projects that are creating jobs and leading to skills that will bring a new future to vulnerable people. Now there's other kinds of projects that are micro enterprise that we can never see how they would be more profitable than maybe 2 to 3%. We want them to break even. We want them to do well. We put management skills, but still the market is not there for them to do better than that. And we couldn't go to you with your $10,000 unless you had a gift of a donation to give us, then we could deploy it in that way. Right? So what we're trying to do is match different kinds of needs of investors or donors with different kinds of enterprises. So it would be a not-for-sale campaign donor project or a Right Reality Fund social venture project. Two different funds. And we deploy them differently. Let me show how we then operate entrepreneurial activity in addressing vulnerable people in modern slavery globally. We consider this as business's mission, because we are followers of Jesus who read Luke 4, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to bring good news to the poor, to bring recovery of sight of the blind, to the acceptable year of the Lord, to demonstrate that we live differently as people of faith, that we live our vocation in a different way, and thereby are a witness to a different kind of reality, a kind of reality where people are valued in community, a kind of reality where our gifts are given as something to serve, not to take advantage of. A different way of thinking. And that's what the world needs today. Open the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Oh my gosh, there's a world that needs to hear the good news of Jesus Christ. We need to start doing business differently. We need to start living our careers differently. That will be a witness to the world. Enough of this, yeah. You know, these four principles or this scripture. People want to see that there's a reality behind the message. I'm a college professor. I know my students at a school that's not an evangelical Christian college. My students at the University of San Francisco are tired of the talk. They want to see some demonstration. Is there any meat to it? Is there any truth to it? Can it be lived out? We need to live differently. That's our challenge as Christians. We need to live differently so that we can then address, yes, there is a gospel that challenges us, transforms us, gives us forgiveness and grace to go out and act in faith to create a different kind of world. Kurnam, the first project. Well, I want to talk about this first, because I don't want to skip over this, because it's really important for us. Because there's a certain myth out there. If you give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. But teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. You've heard that, right? That's not true. It's not true. Yes, if you give a man a fish, he will be dependent upon you. That we call that dependency. So that we have foreign aid or mission projects that give out food or give out resources. And when we leave town, they're left high and dry. While we're there, they're dependent on us. That is not smart philanthropy. But it's better than starving, believe me. So if someone tells me that they're giving fish to someone who's hungry, I do not judge that person. I'm just saying that there's smarter ways of building a future for those people who are vulnerable. You teach a man to fish. Now that's better. That's sustenance. That is, you have now created a sustenance where they can feed themselves, perhaps, by catching their own fish. But their capacity to be a hairdresser or a seamstress or a fisher folk or whatever their skill might be is still dependent on those who control access to the pond. It's sustenance, but it's not sustainability. Now, access to the pond, giving the vulnerable access to the market. Most of those who are poor in the world today do not have access to capital. They are excluded from capital. And you know, this is what I discovered when I started working in the 1980s in Latin America. The poor, every time they get themselves out of the ditch, they're pushed back down by corruption. It's not because of capital markets. They are excluded from the market. Corruption, greed, and human rights excludes them from the possibility of building their own life. Access to the market. So access to the pond is good. That's great, but still, that is not justice. That's sustainability. Justice is when you start giving people equity or ownership in the pond. When they have the possibility of being autonomous, they have the right to determine their destiny. That includes the destiny to choose a Lord and Savior who died for their sins. A freedom to choose. The goal of any economic project should move people towards the freedom and dignity and autonomy that God has given each of us. It's not to keep them dependent on us. It's not to control their access. It's to free them. That has spiritual implications, theological implications. That has economic and political implications. If you believe in God's freedom for all people, then that has implications for the world that we live in. So, let me take you to a couple of projects where we have tried to work in different ways to build this. Kurnam really has been an inspiration to me. When I went around the globe after I found that my local Indian restaurant was the center of a slave activity in the United States, I first went around the United States, then to every continent. And I wanted to figure out how the slave trade worked. In the process, I met this woman named Kurnam, kind of enmeshed in the middle of the kids here. She's a painter, she's an artist. And she used her passion, her gift, to meet the needs of the world. In Chiang Mai, Thailand, where she lived, as she would walk to her studio every day, she saw all these little kids who were sleeping by the riverfront, by the aqueducts of Chiang Mai. So one day she went to her studio, took empty canvases, tins of paint and brushes, went to the riverfront and asked the kids to start painting their story. As they started painting their story, these nightmares start appearing on canvas. Not puppy dogs and rainbows. And she said, "Where do you get these images? They're terrible." They said, "We're not from Thailand. We're from Laos. We're from Burma, Myanmar. We're from Cambodia, as far away as Vietnam and China." "Well, how did you get here?" "Well, many of us were abducted. Others of us, our family sold us because they felt that they sold us, they could keep the other children alive in my family. And others of us were told from Burma, if we came to Thailand, we could go to school. But when we got to Chiang Mai, all of us, we were taken to these bars, these karaoke bars. And men from Germany and the United States and from Australia and from China and Japan, they come. They call themselves sex tourists. And they do things to us that they'd be arrested for doing in their home country." Kurnam couldn't believe it. She was incensed. But then they said, "You know, we're the lucky ones. The lucky ones. Yet every day, right now, there's kids in there, our friends. We live down by the riverfront because we got away. They have to face us every day, men visiting them, doing these things to them." Well, that night, Kurnam, with her righteous indignation, ran into the first karaoke bar she could find, grabbed two little girls and a boy sitting at stools with an adult client, and just ran out. It's not the most sophisticated intervention strategy. I don't recommend you do that today here in St. Louis. But the next night, I understand, I've been in that situation where you just want to do something right then. The next night, she runs into an area karaoke bar, sees two little girls, grabs them, and runs out. When I met Krunam, she had 27 kids and no plan. Mind you, I have four kids and I didn't have a plan, but I had a job, okay? So, here I was. This was, you know, it's funny how you know, vocations start. I felt that, you know, as a writer, I'd written many books. I was executive editor of Sojourners Magazine at one point. I thought, well, the least I could do was to write about this global slave trade, contribute to an awareness. But then I meet Krunam, and I say, okay, I got to do more than that. So I said to Krunam, look, I'm going to write this book. Some people will read it, and they'll ask me what they can do. And I'll say, well, help me build a village or a house for these kids. Because they had to get out of town. Krunam was threatened by the karaoke bar owners. Said, if we see you in town, make sure you take care of that wacko woman. And so she was living on a piece of property up in the Golden Triangle region near Laos. And she had all they had were tents and like lean-to sheds made out of grass. And so I said, look, I'll go home, finish my book, and with the readers who want to do something, we'll build a house for your kids. So I get back to San Francisco. I'm writing. About chapter 2, I get a call from Krunam. David, you know there's 27 kids. Now there's 53. Okay, this better be a damn good book. So I go back. I got to write. You know, I'm writing furiously. I'm in chapter 6. I get another call from Krunam. David, there's 53 kids and there's 88. And I'm like, slow down on the rescues already. 127 kids later, I got to start an agency called the Not For Sale Campaign to build a village for Krunam. And if you go to the north of Thailand today, you will see four houses and a community center and a place where they can grow their own food and potable water and a place where they have a clinic, right? That was all because of a campaign that now is spread around the United States and around the world. That's dependency still, though, right? That's sustenance, right? We're giving them a shot. That's needed. That's necessary. But how do we move beyond that? 127 kids who now have a safe place, which is great. But those who are getting 15, 16, 17, what happens when they turn 18? See you later. Good luck. Well, this is a project then that we've taken as a not-for-sale project. We hope to get maybe 2 to 3%. We never start an enterprise where we don't see it could at least break even. Because otherwise, what good will it do? We want to build financial sustainability, including not for sale itself. We measure our own success based on our ability to bring in more money than we spend. We run it like a startup, a company. Right? So with every project that we start. So we're investing right now in creating a mobile cafe. If you've ever been to a work site where you've seen like the tortilla truck pull up, or you know, coffee and donuts. Well, they're in an area on the border where there's a lot of tourists in that area and movement. So they have a mobile cafe, and they are getting the truck plus all the facilities plus all of the resources for food and coffee, and they're having the 15, 16, 7-year-olds being trained in. This was all their idea. They brought us for a proposal. They said, we think we can make this break even at least. We think we can make a little bit of money. But more importantly, we're going to teach our older kids about how to run a company. Now, if I was in San Francisco dreaming about the best company that could make a profit, I wouldn't be thinking of a mobile cafe. But what is brilliant about this, and very important, it was their idea. They read the market. They did an analysis of how they thought they could create jobs for the kids who are coming out of their own community. So we are going to invest in that because we just did an analysis and said, yeah, that's a break-even business. All right, so there's an example of a micro-enterprise where it's creating jobs and opportunities for those kids who will then go out and have more business skills, more retail skills, and a sense of what it means to work, a discipline about showing up for work, and what happens when you don't show up for work, consequences. That's one way of doing business. All right, shifting to another kind of business, this is something on the other end called the Right Reality Fund is invested in. It's called Earthware Enterprises. And there, we have a very profitable business where we have investors who invest in the company because they expect a return. The company is really fascinating because what it does is it creates greenhouses, it produces greenhouses for the production of organic raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, vegetables and fruits. And it produces these greenhouses out of recyclable steel, 100% recycled steel. So all those Coke cans and old cars that we in America kind of throw over to some dump, it gets sent over to China because American steelmakers don't feel it's profitable or otherwise sustainable to recycle steel. China, on the other hand, has factories that wants to take all of those Coke cans and cars and manufacture them into whatever. So we made a deal with a particular factory in Tianjin, which is not far from Beijing, that part of the quid pro quo for them producing materials for us is that they had to treat their workers differently. Now, I love this because of the fact that the global economy is upon us. How do we shape the global economy in such a way that we have values that are different in the way that we do our business? Most people say you could not run a socially conscious business in China. I wonder if you can run a socially conscious business in Massachusetts. I don't know. But they choose China. It's not true. It's just how you set, again, the framework for what excess capital might mean. Right? What does profit mean? Well, for us, profit means that in the progress of doing business, the workers who are in that factory, they get the kind of conditions that respect their dignity, that they're paid a wage that they can live in a dignified way about. It's a different kind of production. And then those greenhouses, it's funny, this is the global economy. These old cars and Coke cans are going, and paper clips or whatever, are going over to China. They're coming back and being sold to growers in California, Texas, Florida. Very profitable business that returns an environmental impact, a different kind of way of doing business for China, and a return on the investors. With the profits that we make, we can create new companies that globally are making an impact. And one of those new companies for 2010 that I want to share with you, because it demonstrates how we're using business in a different way in Cambodia to try to create a different kind of future for trafficking survivors. And it brings together the not for sale end of what we do and the Right Reality Fund of what we do. It's all entrepreneurial, but it's creating a kind of response to different market conditions. So the example in Cambodia is this. There's a real problem of trafficking. It's a terrible trafficking city, destination or origin, Cambodia. Not only inside Cambodia, but from Cambodia to Thailand, Cambodia to Myanmar, Cambodia to Vietnam, and then Cambodia to the United States and to Europe. Cambodians are just like a commodity. Just like people from the Philippines. Filipinos, Cambodians are people for sale on the world market. There's a glut of poor people who are vulnerable, and there's unfortunately a high degree of buyers who will pay for them. To be house servants in Jordan or Saudi Arabia, to work in a brothel in Dallas or Chicago, to work in brothels, unfortunately, in Thailand and India. Cambodians and Filipinos are for sale. So, on the border between Cambodia and Thailand, we have a center, a rescue center, where we are working with groups that are taking in a shelter. We're going to build a shelter this next year. A shelter for trafficking survivors. Our first target is for 50 survivors of trafficking. We partner with groups like International Justice Mission, who are helping to rescue young people who are in trafficking. They would bring them to our shelter, as well as other organizations that, as we work with local police in Cambodia. Now, that is one part. Now we have created a safe haven. Again, what do we do around entrepreneurial activity that give them a future? What next? Maybe you've heard of Nicholas Kristof. Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. And he went over to Cambodia, bought a young girl, even used New York Times money, got a receipt, right? And then bought her freedom and wrote a story, a column in the op-ed page for the New York Times. A year later, he went back to find this girl, and he was so distraught because he found out that this young girl had gone back to the brothels. And in my mind, as I'm reading it, I said, well, what would you expect to happen? Right, you take a young girl out of a brothel and say, hey, you're free, see you later. Free for what? Rescue villagers, 100 in India. You take them out of the village or the rice mill where they're being imprisoned. You say, now, see you later, you're free. Vulnerable people need more than simply to be let out of their bondage. What does their future look like? How do you help provide a future? That's what it means to move towards justice. Rather than simply teaching how to fish, good luck. How do you build towards justice? Well, we have invested now in a garment factory. It already had 40 workers. We're going to increase the workload. We're going to companies in the United States, surfing manufacturers like, you know, cool board shorts and hoodies and other kinds of manufacturers, say, hey, how would you like to start manufacturing some of your apparel in our factory, our garment factory, that is helping to provide jobs for trafficking survivors in Cambodia? You can use that as a part of your branding. We'd love that, all right? Building business for the garment factory. Now, the garment factory needs trained workers. In the United States, if I need trained workers, there's such a thing called an employment agency. I would perhaps pay someone who has a skill that I need, and I pay a fee for them to be able to bring those skilled workers to me. At the new shelter, we're creating a vocational center. The garment factory is going to pay the shelter for every trained worker who comes out of the shelter and is now brought into the garment factory already as an experienced seamstress because they've been through the vocational program. That is creating a revenue stream for that shelter that previously did not exist. We're building a second shelter in Phnom Penh, the capital, near the garment factory. There, we allow for the workers to buy a piece of their apartment where they live. It's not a shelter anymore where we just give, you know, you pay your rent, or otherwise we just give you free food. With your wages, you can pay a mortgage and you now have equity in your own place. So now, you not only have your own job and getting paid, not only do you then also have a piece of the apartment where you're living, if you decide to leave, you walk away with a sense of empowerment, you walk away with some ownership. Meanwhile, all that rent that's paid, that mortgage, because you've already paid off the apartment building, it goes back to the shelter. So that we have created an environment where the shelter is getting two revenue streams. One, job training. The other, the profits that are coming from the apartment building. The workers are getting equity. It creates an economic environment that's sustainable for that project. That requires entrepreneurial imagination, right? And resources, and deploying those resources in a different way. So that in 25 years from now, I'm not coming here asking you to sponsor one of our children for $27 a month. You want a solution. You do not want me to keep coming to you with the same problem over and over again. And that requires a generation of people who are intelligent, deploy that intelligence in new ways, but also really want to see solutions. You see, as Americans, I think we have to get over the subconscious desire to be in control, to have people dependent on us. We are not called to create dependence. We are called to create disciples of Jesus Christ, right? We're created people who are freed to live the life that God gave them. Well, if you want to have some follow-up time for questions, I'll tell you some immediate action steps. But if some of you might have some questions, I think we have a little bit of time for that. But if you want to somehow get involved in this, there's a not-for-sale academy where we have an entrepreneurial academy. It's a one-week course where you come and we have a very intensive work through how to go about creating entrepreneurial projects in underdeveloped nations particularly. And through that process, you have the opportunity then to write a business proposal that we would fund to go somewhere either where we've set up something or where you have your own idea. So at Entrepreneurial Academy, you can go to the Not For Sale website and find out about that. We also have an investigator workshop. Tomorrow I'll be talking more about the Not For Sale campaign, how we investigate where trafficking is happening. We have a Not For Sale Investigator Academy. We work with the FBI. We work with law enforcement. So we have citizen investigators. So that's an academy going right now, today in San Francisco. YWAM has sent their 25 global leaders to the academy because they want to get involved around the world in fighting slavery in their own backyard. There's for healthcare workers and academies. Look at all the academy offerings. So that's one way you can get involved. The other thing is that we have a tour. We have like a movie on stage. We have live music, video, and I come out for 5 minutes of sound bites. It's called the Stop Paying for Slavery Tour. And you can become an agent of change on your college campus or at your church. Last year we went to 87 cities all around the United States. And so if you want to find out about that, you can look at the website again. We have cards in the back about the Stop Paying for Slavery Tour. We're already going to a lot of cities around the United States next year. So perhaps you want to add your church or university to that agenda. I know we're going to Houston and Fort Myers, Miami. We're going to Toronto. We're going to a lot of cities all over the U.S. and Canada and Mexico and Australia and South Africa. So it's a way of getting engaged. But again, it's about engaging. We're past awareness. You know too much. In fact, we're obese with knowledge. It's about engaging. And how do I engage? There are practical ways to get engaged to change the world. Why do I want to change the world? Because I'm a follower of Jesus. That's what I do. That's what we're called to do. You tell me what your passion is and how you can use that to change the world, whether it's your back door or it's on the other side of the globe. There is no other option if you want to follow Jesus. Jesus doesn't need someone just to repeat what he said. He needs people to live it. Thank you very much for the opportunity today. I'll stay up here. I guess we got run out of time. Thank you very much. I'll stay up here if you want to chat more, because I think we've run out of time. You've got dinner too, some of you? Okay, 10 or 15 minutes? Oh, okay, I thought he was coming to tell me, you know, give me the hook. If you want to follow up with questions, we'll have 10 or 15 minutes. I'm not going to feel bad if you leave. I'm going to ask people to get your name and stuff, but that's besides that. So raise your hand high and feel free to ask questions or make comments.
How are companies held accountable for free to work? Are you relying on human rights watches, or what's the oversight?
Okay, how are companies held accountable through free to work? Well, we have, there are a lot of different standards out there. There's like the Fair Trade Certification, there's the International Labor Organization, ILO standards, there's the Social Accountability 8000 standards. So there's lots, about 15 different standards. We don't try and create a 16th standard. What we do is we look at how they then go about living out their commitment to that standard, right? So we monitor on, we have 40 different metrics which we share openly on the website. That is, do you have a third party monitoring, right? The reason Levi's has a B and not an A is that they do not have independent monitoring. They don't have a third party. They say, no, really, trust us. We monitor it. Well, I'd like to trust you, but enough companies who I trust don't actually follow through. So there are different ways. Apple computer, the iPhone, does pretty well, but Apple says, hey, our competitive advantage is not letting everybody know who our suppliers are, who our manufacturers are. So we say, well, until you are able to solve that, because otherwise how do we really know that you are not using forced labor, and it's a great cover. So, you know, you take it with a grain of salt in terms of how they understand what their competitive advantage is. But we have questions like, do you allow spot checks? Right? Do you allow spot checks? That is it when they're, you know, because if I say there's a factory in China and they make sure they send us the books every 6 months, well, how do I know really that they're just not doctoring the books, right? So there's different ways of measuring that. But if you look through the 40 different measures that we use about the grading, you'll see, wow, that's pretty exhaustive. And you'll see why some companies get an F and some people get an A. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering, so for the certification, if using the cocoa example, if someone refuses buying a chocolate bar that may have used slave labor, and so they would feel good about themselves for making a difference, and also a company earning a good rating on your certification, they would look better for making a difference against the slave labor. I was just wondering if there is a way to that it's through Christian initiative, it's through God's work that this is begun, and that it is a God initiative to try to end slave labor.
Yeah, well, you know, there's lots of different pieces of that question I'd like to address. The first thing is that I think it's important to shift demand rather than boycott. That's just our strategy. So we promote, there's a whole bunch of great chocolate companies like Theo Chocolate, Divine Chocolate. I don't know why they all have, like, theological names. Maybe God and chocolate's very connected. But there's some great equal exchange that, you know. But they have some great chocolate, and so we try and shift demand. That's why the chocolate campaign is, hey, buy a chocolate bar where actually people's lives are enabled rather than people's lives are devastated, right? So I think it's strategic to show that shift in demand. The reason Cadbury's has stopped in the UK market using slave labor in their chocolate manufacturing is because they see that there's enough shifting of demand. Right? Fair trade is growing by leaps and bounds in the UK market. We want to make that happen here. In terms of the piece of, you know, the Not For Sale campaign, we are a campaign to end slavery. We are not a Christian campaign because of the fact, even though all of us are followers of Jesus, we want to say this is why we are motivated to bring about an end to a global problem. We are motivated to do such. But you know what? We have rabbis and synagogues. We have people who are human rights activists from different kinds of persuasions. They join our campaign. Corporations. I've spoke this year at Google, Facebook. I get to speak at Microsoft. I get to speak at companies where otherwise those doors would be closed to us. Because we very simply say we want to stop slavery. We want to end slavery. If you ask me why I'm motivated, I'll tell you why. But rather than somehow wear on our sleeve our religiosity, we would rather live it and then express later. It's a strategy. I don't feel... IGM is a great example of an organization that says, you know, this is our Christian witness and they're a Christian organization. That is, for them, a strategic decision of how they are going to engage the world and how they're going to express their faith. I look very highly at IGM. But we have chosen a different path.
And the slave process or whatever is bound and the company wants to change the impact it's having and stop that, does the place usually shut down or can it be converted into an environment where they are paid?
No, certainly. The question is therefore, are places that are used forced labor today, do they cease to exist? It depends. Sometimes they, you know, the owner, the only way that he operates is by taking people into captivity and deploying them. I can think of rice mills in India where I visited, or brick kilns, where that's the case. But in terms of, say, we're talking about the chocolate manufacturing, you see that there are cocoa fields who change the way they go about doing their behavior. Or apparel manufacturers in Asia, I've seen, change their behavior because they see pressure being put on the demand. Right? So yes, there is conversion or transformation of that industry, and that's what we're after. That's what we're after, because at the end of the day, you want to create economic livelihood for as many people as possible through your work, rather than simply shutting it down. Because it's hard then to create enough micro-enterprise to take advantage of all those people who are being displaced. Go ahead. We'll go here and there and there. Go.
Okay, so my question is, since such a variety of projects are involved, there's government factories who have built shelters and try to have some profit from the rent to pay for the other kids. How do you make sure that all this business will remain profitable, because they are in such a variety of areas and fields and you don't have the expert knowledge or...
Yeah, so the question is, how do you ensure that there's profitability in those projects? And part of the I was involved as an investment banker at a point in my life, we would look at, well, who's the entrepreneur? Can they be trusted? Do they have any experience? What would demonstrate to us that they actually could build an enterprise? The reason we have an entrepreneurial academy in San Francisco is that we often will want to this next year place an entrepreneur who has that experience, has that training, either because they have built a business or maybe they went through a business school and they actually demonstrated a knowledge and understanding and wisdom in the practice of that knowledge. You're right. It'd be crazy for us just to throw money because someone sent us a proposal. We do a due diligence. We turn down far more enterprises than we fund. We really want to make sure that they're financially sustainable. The social part of it, usually in the projects that we get, That's probably, you know, yeah, probably lead to good results. Rather, it's how is it going to sustain itself financially is the bigger challenge. Now, we hold ourselves to the same rigor, by the way. The Not For Sale campaign, we have a weekly dashboard with 82 metrics, measuring everything from how many donors we got for a project to how many people went to our website, how many subscribers do we have to a newsletter. We set certain goals, and every week we see this dashboard, and we say, okay, how are we doing? So we hold ourselves to the same measure. Are we being effective and efficient? Now, people come, and you know, particularly those coming right out of college, they say, oh my gosh, I thought I was joining a nonprofit. This feels like some kind of IBM or something. We say, no, you know what? We really want to be effective at our cause, and our cause is to change the world, stop slavery. Shouldn't we hold ourselves to a high standard? Shouldn't we make sure that we have a performance? Now, if you as a staff member are not reaching your metrics, then we need to figure out, did we put you in the wrong place? And then we might shift you around. But after several evaluations, we might say, you know what? It doesn't sound like this is your kind of work, because we really do expect performance. Wouldn't it be wonderful if churches and ministries ran with a degree of sense of what's our goal, what do we seek to accomplish, how do we measure whether or not we actually are succeeding in our mission, whatever that mission might be. It doesn't necessarily have to be obviously a prophet. It might be, are we reaching our mission in Indonesia to create churches? Well, how do we measure our effectiveness?
I don't mean to be religious or anything.
You can be. That's all right.
I support this. And the thought that comes to mind is, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, in this case, freedom, but loses his own soul? I mean, are we releasing people from the slavery of sin? Is the gospel being preached to people?
You know, for us, you know, we're highly motivated to free people from the bondage that they're in so that they can choose. They have the freedom to choose the destiny. It may be just like many of us. We choose other idols to chase. I mean, many of us chase, we're free, right? But we chase the idols of materialism. We chase the idols of chemical dependence. We chase the idols of what it means to be successful, the American dream. We don't choose freely to pursue God and the Savior Jesus Christ. Well, what we're trying to offer, the opportunity at least for people to choose their own spiritual destiny. And unfortunately, people don't always make the best choices in that. But certainly we're committed to that. We don't deny the fact of what our motivation is or who we are. But on the other hand, I think there's unfortunately a tradition of the Christian church operating internationally to somehow hold almost people's freedom, people's sustenance, people's livelihood, it hostage to their acquiescence to our message. And I think we need to believe that the truth of the gospel will shine through in our actions. Believe in the power of the gospel rather than trying to control that message. I take your question as a sincere one. I do want to say this. I was speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast. I say this as seed for thought. I was at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. speaking. And before I went on, there's about five speakers before me. And each of them spoke about prayer, spiritual growth. I was asked to speak about how a believer acts in the world. And I spoke about changing the face of slavery. When I got done, hand went up and the audience question and answer said, you know, you didn't mention prayer or spiritual growth. And I said, I would love to address that, because for me, prayer sustains me. Spirituality is an important value that I think all people should be able to embrace and hopefully will follow God's truth. But I have a question. I just heard four speakers, and not once after they finished did someone say, excuse me, but you never said anything about giving freedom to the captives or holding those who are poor in God's love, or giving recovery of sight to the... You didn't say anything about those other aspects of the gospel. But as soon as I spoke about living out Luke 4, my spirituality somehow is suspect. Why is that? Why is it that we have that kind of schizophrenic or bipolar gospel? Of course, we should hold them together. John Stott: I do not proclaim the gospel without trying to identify with it, nor do I identify the gospel without proclaiming it. How do we hold those together so that indeed all people will say, gosh, you know those Christians? See, I want to ride a bus in St. Louis one day reading my Bible, and I want someone next to me to say, are you one of those Christians? And I go, well, I'm a follower of Jesus. I kind of have this, the Christian word kind of trips me up sometimes. Oh, I hate you guys. Really? Why? You're always going on about the poor. Wherever there's conflict in the world, you're trying to be peacemakers. I mean, and you're so humble. Wouldn't you love for the gospel to be justified or rejected based on its truth? How often do you hear that? Mostly what I hear from my students, oh, you Christians are hypocrites. I would love for the equation to swing the other way. Oh, you guys just drive me crazy because you're always on the wrong side of history. Whose wrong side? I'm going to let you guys go eat dinner. Thank you very much for being patient with me. Love you.